Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Deep Thoughts. Today we're going to cover a fun subject that I have sort of touched on in various episodes, but we're going to dedicate a whole episode to it because I was just thinking, as a No Country for Old Men kind of guy now, there's just certain memories I have, and this particular subject is actually coming back. There are people opening these type of venues because people are getting tired of the virtual BS that's going on out there. And I am talking about arcades. Now, what's interesting is I'm saying arcades and I'm 46 years old. If you're around my age, you're like, oh yeah, of course I've been to an arcade. But I mean, if you're in your early 20s, late teens, you're looking at me like, well, I kind of know what they were. So we're going to go through what they were and how much fun they were. But before we do, let me show you some similarities of the world that you have now and the world that was just preceding arcades in the 70s. You know, arcades simply didn't exist, and then they did. And, you know, I was kind of young, so I wasn't quite sure exactly what year they started, but, you know, you can look up, I think Space Invaders was technically a 1973 game, something like that. But I would say by 1977, things were full bore. And what had occurred is, we all had computers. Every country had computers and the world had computers, but homes did not have computers. And computers were pretty much, you know, number crunchers. That was it, usually for war. I think a guy named Ivan Sutherland was the first guy to actually digitally plot a pixel on the screen on a Cartesian XY coordinate system, you know, and say, there you go, there's a dot. And once that dot hit the screen, everyone started thinking. And soon enough, chess games came out and checker games came out. And eventually, somebody took it into fantasy and created a space one, right? So the first thing that was created, as far as I know, is a consumer game, was called Pong. And I believe it was an Atari unit. And you've all seen this, you know, you got two little flipper things and a ball going back and forth. And it's sort of like any sport where there's a goal. If you miss it, it goes through your side of the screen. My parents bought one of these. Must have been around 77 or so. And I got extremely good at it as a kid. I would play the adults, and they always thought that was a really funny thing because all these adults would try to play. And, of course, they don't have the open mind to the new format. So for them, they're struggling with the paradigm of using a knob and controlling pixels on the screen. So all that was brand new, and here I am just, like, falling into it, no problem. So an average child could have beat pretty much any adult at that era. But I didn't think much of it because the Pong thing got really boring really fast. What else did man do at the time, though, for fun? Well, we did board games. And those are pretty damn fun. I know it almost sounds like a double entendre. But board games were Monopoly, Yahtzee. My family didn't own Life, or my grandmother owned Life. We didn't own Life in my house. Sorry, it was another board game we used to play. Tons of fun. But now I'm in the Midwest at the time, personally, and my family relocated to a suburb of a major city, Wichita, Kansas, and I'm in Derby. And I do not believe I had ever seen an arcade game really up close before then. But what had occurred is that the company Atari went ahead and created what's called the Atari 2600. And if you've ever seen a retro home console video game, you've seen the picture of the Atari 2600. It's this odd brown thing with black, you know, body on it. It was almost like everyone's house had lots of paneling back in the day. And so this was sort of to match the times, right? But it had a little cart in it, and you pushed it in the front. And the cart actually maintained the program on a chip. And it would download it into the CPU, and then you could play it, which is kind of funny. No moving parts, right? You know, kind of we were on the right track until discs came out, and then all of a sudden we have moving parts again, and once you have moving parts, you have something that's going to break. And just so you know, the industry loves moving parts. Car industry, electronics industry, anytime they come up with a medium that moves, they love it because something breaks. And that causes obsolescence in their product line. But the 2600 comes out, and the only game that you can play right off the bat is Tank Wars, which is pretty damn cool. And what I didn't realize, and I think I said this in a previous episode, is that the 2600 had such limited memory that whatever screen you're looking at, the background graphic, was actually mirrored from left to right. And you don't think that's true until you start looking at the old games. You're like, oh my god, they're all just mirror images of what's in the background. And the only exception to the rule was a game that they had ported called Star Castle, where there simply were no background elements. Everything was plotted on the screen as a foreground object. Horrible game, but brilliant idea how this guy tried to convert it out. So, 2600 hits my home. We're playing Tank Wars. I can't really remember a lot of the other games on it. The game that everyone always wanted was Missile Command. Missile Command was a game where you had three cities that you had to protect from incoming missiles. And so you would guide your cursor up and launch nuclear missiles to intercept nuclear missiles coming in. Because it was one of the coolest games in the arcade, which we're going to get to in a sec here. Let's just get to it right now. So imagine you're sitting in your house and you have the top telephone. This is 2016. Your top tablet or iPad. The top laptop, and you're in your living room, and the pattern of your input is nothing more than the living room you've been in your whole life, right? Or this stage in your life. But every day you wake up in the same place, and you just sort of live inside this house, and the only escape you've got is to look into a screen. Maybe put some headsets on to make it a little bit more immersive. Maybe you've got a HTC Gear VR thing to put your phone in. But that's essentially the extent of 2016's imagination for your entertainment experience. And then I come and get you in a time machine. It's 1978. Summer. And I pull up today and I grab you and I get you in my machine, but that's where I'm taking you. And I'll take you to a little town called Derby, Kansas. And we pull up to the arcade. And here we are in the middle of, you know, BF Egypt. We're not in any town that's rolling in a tremendous amount of money. But I'm going to take you into an arcade. It's in a strip mall, off sort of the main thoroughfare that cuts the whole town in half, right? You see a bunch of kids in bell bottoms, t-shirts. If they're wearing shorts, they have tube socks and other crazy things on. Everyone's being really nice to each other. There's no gang-banging feeling around. We simply don't work like that. But as we approach the door, before we even go in, you can start feeling the sound in the ground. Because in the room that we're about to enter is anywhere between, 30 and 50 arcade games. 30 to 50 upright wood cabinets full of subwoofers, right? Now, my first experience was at this location I'm giving you, so hopefully this is kind of cool. So we go in the front door, and the first thing you notice is that it's all black inside. The carpet's black, and yes, it has carpet. The walls are black. The machines are all black as a base color, typically, but there's gorgeous paint jobs on both sides. But it's sort of stenciled on. Yet the first game you're going to see is actually a really odd one that you won't see again. It's actually a game where you get up on two skis. It has two ski poles. You physically get inside this thing. And it's right in the front door because it is the latest and greatest thing to come into the arcade. And you look at it and you realize that they've essentially connected the controls of these skis that you step in, and you go left and right, and it controls the direction of a guy going down a ski slope in the arcade monitor right in front of you. Later, you're going to see this actually pulled into Intellivision's home system. But this is where it actually was invented, right in front of your face. And this machine is one of the only machines that's not completely pitch black, because they've painted it to look like snow. And it's a little larger because you got to actually get into it. And this is 1978. You're thinking, damn, I thought they were all just stand-up little clickety-click games, right? So then we get further in. We get about 6 feet inside this room. And now you are hearing the utter collage of incredible sounds, from the sounds of shots being fired in video games, like various spaceships and things. You hear a little bit of sort of a driving game somewhere. You're not quite sure where it is. You're hearing thumping and thumping and thumping of space invaders. You hear the quiche noise that comes out of every single fire back to them, right? It's immersive. It's deep. And it looks like you could spend the entire day in here and probably still not play every single game once. But as I take you into one of these arcades, everything is organized in a very tight space, because the room isn't really as big as it needs to be. And so it's sort of a catacomb of people. You know, everything's beautifully mapped out. Because these cabinets are pretty big, they can actually create a maze just by the way they stack up the cabinets in the room. And so it's always interesting. And it's just, there's plenty of room to get around everyone. But then all of a sudden you have a problem. We're trying to get toward the back because I want to take you all the way from front to back just to kind of give you the tour. But all of a sudden now, there's a huge glob of people. And it's suddenly a little bit difficult to get through this area. And we're starting to wonder, you know, what's going on? Why can't we get through this particular area? Why is everyone hunched up around this machine? And that's because a guy is getting a potential world record on one of the machines. Physical interaction with other human beings, actually standing in a room, doing something other than polluting your bloodstream. You're having anywhere from, say, 14-year-old kids all the way up to 50-year-old dudes in one room having a blast. Everyone's focused. Everyone has quarters. As we push through to the back, that's where we get a couple, maybe like 6 pinball machines. And they're analog, meaning there's no digital circuits in them whatsoever. Maybe we get a Lucky Strike 4-player game. Maybe we get a Close Encounters 2-player. Maybe we get a Gold Rush 4-player. The two biggest manufacturers are Williams and Gottlieb. And the way you can tell the difference is to look at the flippers. If the flippers are really sharp, it's a Williams. If they're really round and puffy, it's a Gottlieb. And you just know that because you've been around. And as low-tech as it is, while we're waiting for a couple machines to free up in the arcade, we put a couple quarters in the pinball game, and man, if it isn't as fun as hell. Bumpers take the ball into a whole new universe. You're, instead of staring into a little tiny digital OLED screen, you're now staring directly into a huge physical tabletop of utter craftsmanship. Everything that's going on in this on this board here is the physical mastering of craftsmanship from, you know, one giant ejection crevice that leans into something else, into a ramp, into a flipper. And oddly enough, on the pinball games, when all the little diodes and flippers and stoppers and bumpers start firing up, the grease and the electricity that's cooking all the components inside this box start to emit just a tiny scent. And it becomes something that you can never get playing a PlayStation, playing on your cell phone. This experience only. And without walking in and smelling the aged wood, and smelling everything that's been there. And this pinball game that we're playing, by the way, is 20 years old, and it's 1978. So you're playing a piece of heritage, right? The predecessor to the arcade game. which by 2016 itself will be 20, 30 years old. But now it's time for us to play a game. And there's a lot of choices. In 78, probably the most popular game is Space Invaders. Second most popular game, it's about to debut, is Asteroids. And all the games are beautifully designed. And what's wild about them is that there hasn't been anything in the planet Earth remotely like this in your lifetime, in my lifetime. And somehow these folks at Konami and Atari, Midway, but we got to get some quarters, right? Either bought our own or we got to find the guy in the room that's going to take our dollar bill and split it up into four quarters. There are no machines that you can feed a dollar into and it dumps out the quarters. That doesn't come for another decade. 7 or 8 years. So we get our quarters and we put it in there. And now you're staring into a cabinet. And what's very interesting about the design of a cabinet, and it may have been nothing more than serendipity, but it may have been a stroke of utter genius. The same way that you look into your telephone screen, and the telephone screen becomes your reality. You look across the room at a flat screen television, and that becomes your reality. An arcade game has a cabinet with a monitor that's tilted in, right? Yeah, a lot of times they are drawn incorrectly, where the screen is, you know, flat to your face. It's not like that at all. That screen is laid down inside this chamber. And in your mind, the paint job, any of the internal lights, you look down into the bowels of this box. And it becomes your world. And the sound is coming out of the top of the title piece up above, right? And usually the power button, by the way, is right up on the right or left of the top of the box. So if you ever want to turn one off, it's usually in the front or towards the back, but usually in the front. With Space Invaders, it's got this amazing thump. And the thump is used to dramatically increase the pressure of the tension in the moment. So you put your coin in, and man, it has that little sound, you know? Just like the sound in a phone booth. I don't know if you guys know it, but it was the sound of the of a quarter bouncing through chambers in a phone booth that actually allowed it to know it wasn't a slug, wasn't a false coin. I thought that was pretty amazing. Now, arcade games never had that tech. Still makes a cool sound, though. But as it starts up the game, the thump starts, and it's really slow. Dum, 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 right? And there's a armada of these really cute digital aliens stepping left until they hit a boundary, and then they go right until they hit the boundary, and then they go left. And every time they change directions, they drop a pixel or two. And you've got your little ship down at the bottom, and I think about four barriers. And these little guys are dropping little spaghetti missiles on you, and you're shooting your missile up at them. And it's all a little bit of timing. You can't shoot infinite missiles. You can only put, one missile in the sky at once. If not that, you can only do a few. So you have to wait for that missile to actually run into somebody. I think it had to do with memory in these machines. But it also beautifully matched a really great design. But the longer it takes you to kill these things, the faster they move, the faster the bump moves, and your heartbeat starts to coincide with this subwoofer. Until the tension builds up, until you nail the last guy who's screaming across the screen because he gets going really, really fast, and now it's all about timing. Your barriers are all beat to shit. And that last round, that last shot, you hit him. And that heartbeat that is sped way, way up, both in your body and in the subwoofer of this cabinet, slows back down again. You get a whole new set of guys, and we start all over again. That was the first most successful video game I ever made, other than Pong. Now, they did have upright Pong games. I think that was the first one in 73. It was an upright Pong game. I can't even imagine playing that, but, you know, to each generation, we'd never seen something like that before. Now, what's going to happen is that while you're there, you're probably going to play Space Invaders, I don't know, half an hour to an hour. And then you're going to realize when you pull back from this machine that there's 20 other machines. There's 20 other games, and whether or not they suck or not, you want to play every single one of them. Because it's just a unique experience. And secretly, you sort of want to get good at them. Because oddly enough, at the end of this game you just played, it checks to see if your score is high enough to be in the top 10. Now, most of you that play video games and play anything online that has a high score, a leaderboard, as they say, virtually all of them have been hacked. It doesn't matter what provisions they make on the back end or the front end. Typically, they're hacked because it's easy to do. And I won't go into all that bullshit. But in arcade games, you had to physically walk up to the machine and play it to get on the top 10. And then you had three initials you could put into the system if you happened to make it into the top 10. And you used your controls to go through A through Z. And you get your initials in there. And then they never turn the machines off at night. So you could come back a month later and you could still have a high score on the machine. And it was your, and you could go all over town having a conversation about the video game and say, yeah, I got second on the leaderboard. Or I got, yeah, I'm the high score on that game. Go take a look. Here's my initials. Boom, boom, boom. And you had this beautiful tag of status, right? It was awesome. Consequently, the guys who were really, really good often would just use AAA because that was the default letter for all the pops. And essentially what they were doing is saying, I don't even care that I got the high score. AAA. One of the other funny ones that pretty much sprung up in the 80s was FUQ. That was another real famous one. Or as you can imagine, ass. Any three-letter dirty word. But now Space Invaders was black and white. A 2-bit color game. Essentially using all the other memory that was available in the machine to be the logic of the game. Now the most amazing thing about Space Invaders, and I'm almost done with that one, then we'll move a lot faster through the other ones, is that the rubble on your little barriers was actually phenomenal. It was pixel-specific, random, you know, destruction on all of your barriers, which I thought was amazing. It wasn't canned, as far as I know. If it was, brilliantly done, because I couldn't tell. Let me tell you something else about arcade games. And this might be a little, and again, I'm talking about America. So let's say you and I put a quarter in a game, and for whatever reason, the quarter didn't go down through the chute properly and didn't register the play. And there's people watching. Now, there's always a guy or a girl or two of them walking around with the apron with one of these, quarter dispensers, sort of like at a drive-up restaurant, like an A&W root beer or a Sonic, right, where they're on roller skates and stuff, right? But you'll still see these in America. And I assume that this technique was done in Europe as well. But Europe renews their money so much. I'm not sure if this is the case. In America, if you ever have old coins, quarters were pure silver until about 64. And then 65, the ruling class got a really good idea to say, we're going to make things called quarters. And we're going to fill them with other bullshit so they're not exactly worth a quarter. Because we never want anyone to have any real sovereign money here. So let's take our pennies and fill them with zinc. And let's take our quarters and fill them, I think, with the same stuff, copper lining or whatever. But if you have any quarters, 65 and up in America, probably till about 1990, as far as the minted year of the quarter. If it looks like it's ever been painted black, then you may have a quarter that was used at an arcade. The black quarters, and I see them every once in a while, and I always like try to educate everyone in the room real quick. It's just a little piece of trivia, and their minds always blow. Is that if you ever had a quarter that didn't go through a machine properly, what happened was the arcade wanted to know what machines were having problems over other machines, And so they take a whole batch of quarters. I would love to see this done. I don't even know what kind of paint they used because it did not come off, right? They line up a bunch of corners, paint them all black, both sides, let them dry out, and then they would use these quarters to give you when you needed to replace one that didn't work right. And so when they opened up the arcade and pulled out the coin bucket, the more black quarters were inside that, they knew that this machine needed to be serviced. I even think that there were red quarters that were based on freebie giveaways. And so they would know, hey, if you're going to give away free quarters, you know, someone deserved one or something, they would know how many of those that they were giving out. I'm pretty sure at least one place I know did that. So you've pretty much had my first experience in an arcade game location, in an arcade, excuse me, about 1978. I first walked in. Now we move it up a little bit, and the games evolved. Now, one of the saddest things about the recreations of video games from the past to today is that there was a piece of technology that we have to simulate today because we can't just make it happen on any one of our computers or flat screen monitors or even our tubes in our house. But there was something called vector graphics. I'm very, very familiar with the anatomy of a normal television tube, but I am not specifically familiar with how this is done. But essentially, there was a set of probably some of the best video games on planet Earth, and you could use a tube that drew graphics on the screen sort of in a polygon-type fashion. And it was some sort of laser that would hit the screen, and then it would draw the shape. And so when you were programming the video game, I believe you just saved the points in space and in a flat Cartesian coordinate system, XY system, and it would essentially draw the characters. And the most beautiful games ever done, there's three that are just classic, right? There's Asteroids, and there was Asteroids Deluxe, but essentially it was the same exact video game with different shaped characters and like a couple of different features. Star Wars, the very first sit-down Star Wars video game ever, and a game called Battlezone. Those are the three most popular vector graphics games. Now, there was... But that was the next step up from your arcade game that was like Space Invaders, where it's just black and white pixels. But there's nothing like the sounds that come out of these two games. Or three games, excuse me. So Asteroids had this incredible soundtrack that if you can hear it, just in you could be 100 feet away. When you shoot a little missile in Asteroids, it has this little ping noise, this little pew, pew, little noise. And that noise became utterly synonymous with that machine. And you would beautifully walk to that machine because when you went to an arcade, you would obviously attract yourself to the sound of whatever the hell it is you love. And what you'll do is you're willing to use some of your quarters to explore brand new games, but you wanted to get in there and play your favorite game right away. No mystery, right? The Star Wars game had three phases of space battle. Then it had the surface of the Death Star battle. And then it had the trench in the Death Star. And that just kept repeating and repeating until it got more and more intense. It was probably... The most amazing thing about that game is that someone actually programmed three-dimensional transformations in a video game way back in the day, meaning you were looking at three-dimensional surfaces calculated in 3D coming at the screen and then plotted in a 2D coordinate system. The reason why that's amazing is that the amount of processor power we had was unbelievably negligible. All of these machines are programmed in a language called assembly, which is one step up from binary. Nobody programs in binary. But these guys were utter and complete geniuses to be able to make these games the way they were. The other one was probably sort of a mixture, which was Battlezone, where you're in a tank. And the big deal about Battlezone was that you had two controllers like a tank. And so you push them both forward, you go forward. You pull them back, you go backwards. You twist them, you start turning your tank. Unfortunately, it didn't have a technique of actually swiveling the turret separate than the tank body, but it was good. The backstory of Tron, when they made the movie Tron from 1980 to 82, Jeff Bridges, Steven Lisberger, the director, actually had a Battlezone game on set. He had lots of video games on set just to make sure everyone was sort of in the tone of, hey, you're inside one of these games in this movie. But I guess Jeff Bridges got incredibly addicted to Battlezone to the point where they would have to pry him off the machine to come do his roles, to come do his lines, right? Really funny. So that was the step up from regular pixels, right? Then, out of the blue, and I am not sure what games were the very first ones to do this. I'm just going to name a few, and I don't know historically which ones went first. But there was this moment when we got color. Where not only could you put a pixel on the screen, but you could give it a color. Sounds silly, right? Because that's the world you live in today. Some of the first ones I remember ever were Centipede. I think one of the most artistic games I saw, let's just go for the Big Mama. At least by 1983, there was a really strange game called Crazy Climber. The game is that you're this kind of bizarre looking humanoid character, and all you can see is your back. And you have four arms and legs, and you have these really weird, you know, ball controllers up and down, standard arcade grips. And you're moving your left side of your body and then the right side of your body. And you have to essentially grapple up the face of a building. The building was, for the time, was damn near photoreal. The character was a little bit awkward on the body, but they had to geometrically match it to the grid of the window sills that you're climbing up. You had bad guys throwing pots of potted plants at you, right? So the old orange potted plant with the daisy in the top trying to smack you in the head. You had a big stork-like seagull character flying around dropping poop on you, which was hilarious because that was sort of edgy to have something crap on your head. I believe you had a maiden that you could rescue out of a window. If you just touched her, you rescued her. I think that's correct. And I believe that the goal of the game was simply to get to the top of this particular building that you're climbing on. And of course, the building got taller and taller and taller. The game is barely remembered from any of my friends, but it had a very quirky soundtrack too. But I remember looking at it and playing it at a bar next to the movie theater I was working at. And it's one of these things where I wasn't technically supposed to be in the bar, but it was Kansas. I think it's the first time I heard the song Jack and Diane by Mr. Cougar, who's now Mr. Mellencamp. But the other one was Dig Dug. Dig Dug, you're this little pudgy little character who is digging in the ground. If you guys remember it, soil had different layers of clay color, and you would just dig straight down into the ground, and he'd just dig, dig, dig with his little pickaxe, and there were little dragons down there and little openings, right? Which is so funny, of the reptilian stories we hear about them in the ground. just occurred to me. But you punch a hole in there, and now they're going to come after you. And so at that point, you had this little, little trigger where you could hit them with a pump. And you're essentially pumping them up, and they kept getting fatter and fatter and fatter until you basically make their bodies erupt and explode. Boy, that game was fun. But up to this point, we've had an evolution in the games themselves, from black and white pixels to vector graphics, which could be colored as well. Consequently, some of the vector graphics cheated. Vector graphics usually came in one color. And then finally they got a chance to make even the vector graphics different color. And Star Wars was definitely a game that took advantage of this. But I believe that there were games that actually put a gel on top of the monitor. And so they would do it in black and white, but you had essentially a piece of red film that was over the monitor, so that any vector graphics plotted in that region were red. And because of the way the game design worked, nothing was allowed to traverse in the area except your little ship might kind of go through that area every once in a while. But I don't think that happened very often. But up to this point, everything is either single player or multiplayer. However, when we switched from multiplayer, it was essentially, you would say, I want to have one person play the game or two people play the game. But every time it was your turn, it was like pinball. The ball went down the chute. Now you get to go. And the screen resets, and it's my world, and I play until I die. And then it switches the score, switches all your saved guys, you know, and you get to play your round. And it just kept going back and forth until one of you, until both of you die, and then the high scores were compared or whatever. Now, I'm sure that the game I'm about to mention isn't the first one to do this, but I'm going to tell you it's the best one that ever did this in the 80s. There was a game called Gauntlet. Gauntlet was an unbelievable advancement in arcade games. And the game is a Dungeons & Dragons type game. You could play a wizard, a barbarian, or an archer. The archer was a chick. The wizard was like a standard Gandalf-looking guy. And your barbarian was just a Conan-looking character. Now, this game was down at my local Quick Trip, west of town. And you walked up to it, and it was massive. And it was massive because it had three different controllers right in front of your face. And so you could actually walk up to it and cue three people at once. And then you could co-op, play at the same exact time in the same game. And I guess it was Warrior. That's what they call it. Now, this game had full graphics in terms of where you were, and the other games I mentioned did as well. But this had sort of a top-down view into a room. They had a maze that had walls that you would trip triggers and pull down the wall. And behind the walls, a whole fleet of bad guys. It also had areas where these bad guys would spawn out of. And skeletons, the undead, were one of the key enemies. And you have this pile of bones on the ground. And they just keep spawning out of the pile of bones until you shot the pile of bones and killed it. And once you cleared the whole thing, you're okay. But you didn't have to clear the whole level because there were little exits that are usually behind several barriers. So you have to kill several things to get to it. But you guys could line up. And the barbarian obviously had amazing strength, amazing hit points. But your wizard had less hit points on his body, but he hit for a lot harder. And the archer, she could stand way, way back and throw stuff. And everyone had a throw weapon. So the warrior had a hatchet he would throw. Of course, the wizard's casting these little spells. But what became really, really famous about this game was that when you died, it had a really funny sound because it would it'd have some guy go, oh, like this. And that was pretty popular in the brain when you would walk into an arcade. If you wanted to know if they had Gauntlet, just listen. And that's what was so cool about this thing, right? The other one was when you started dying, the machine would say, Warrior needs food. And you'll hear people my age make little references to that every once in a while if they ever got into Gauntlet. And they made Gauntlet 2 and that kind of thing, but for the most part, they got it right in the very first version. And so Gauntlet 2 was just a little bit more of the same thing. I can't remember. I'm sure they had more features. Maybe they even added another class, but it was phenomenal. You could go up and play it by yourself, of course, or you could just have people, and people could join in. So you'd be playing the game, and a guy comes up and throws his quarter in, and they automatically have help, which is what we do now in games like, you know, World of Warcraft and that kind of stuff. But this is the very first one, probably about 84, 85, right? Now I want to tell you an experience about this high score thing, because it's something we simply don't experience anymore. Now, I think I said a long time ago that when arcades came out, it took about 5 to 6 years before it hit the news that kids were playing too much in these arcades. They go down all day long and play. Whatever money they made from mowing a lawn, from working at a local convenience store or whatever, they spent every freaking dime at these places. But I lived, like I said, 100 miles away from this big city that I used to live just south of. Because I used to live there. I used to live in my small town. Then I moved over to the suburb. Then I went away to Massachusetts and came back to my little town. So it was like 100 miles away. It's a 2-hour drive. Because we have police officers that would, highway patrolmen that would catch you if you sped. The arcade in my town east mall in Wichita, Kansas. I believe it was called a Grand Prix Arcade or something like that. Doesn't matter. Huge freaking place. Probably 50 to 100 arcade games spread all over this place with the pinball section, and pinball machines went digital. And I remember walking in and this Asteroids game was roped off. with the red rope, right? And there was a dude sitting there. Well, obviously one guy's playing the game, and there was a guy sitting there in a kind of an upright kind of bar stool chair with a piece of paper and a clipboard. And I walk up to it, and in Asteroids, you were given three lives when you started the game. And, you know, you could get extra levels once you hit a certain score pop. And this dude had extra ships completely off the screen. And so the dude next to him was keeping track of how many extra lives he had off the screen. Ooh, he was going for the world record. And so I'm sitting there, and he's pretty much mindlessly playing this thing. So I started just asking him questions. I said, you know, mind if I talk to you? I'm probably like 15 years old. And I said, well, you know, what do you do when you go to the restroom? He goes, I just go. He goes, I just knock it all down to one asteroid flying around. I put my ship in an area where I don't think it's going to hit me for a while. But he goes, I just go to the restroom and I lose lives, but I'm back before I lose too many lives. Then I just crank them all back up again. So my jaw is on the ground, right? So I do my thing and I go home. And I only come back every weekend if I'm lucky, right? Well, I come back the next weekend. And the dude's still there. He sleeps there. And there's someone on an 8-hour shift watching all of these lives, and they wake him up before it's too late. And he resurrects the game. My uncle and my cousin went over 2 weeks later. So we're now at least 3 weeks later. The guy had already been there a week before, and I've met him the very first time. This dude played this game for 1 month and got the world record. Crazy. I'm sure it was clobbered somewhere else real quickly, but Star Castle was the other one I was thinking, the other vector graphic one. We had a kid in my hometown who was headed towards the world record of Star Castle. He played it and played it and played it forever. He played it so long that a storm rolled into town, and we're in tornado. We're not actually in Tornado Alley, but we're definitely in the tornado realm. But a lightning bolt struck the highest building in the building complex that he was in down on Main Street and killed the power. And so he lost his everything, his high score, everything, just before he was making it. Bummer, right? But now let me tell you an experience that we used to have. And I just don't know if it happens now, because when you take a game and you put it on the global world, you know, network known as the internet, there's always one person out there that's either cheating, which is 90% of all the high scores out there in any game, or there's just someone out there that's better than you and has no life. But what was nice about arcades is that it was localized to your local area of people. I guess you could say sociologically our local skill set, our local IQs, whatever. And so you could put a score on a game and it could sit there for a really long time. Now, I walked into this arcade in my home in that Wichita area, and I was a huge Tron kid when I was a kid, the 82 Tron. And the Tron video game is actually kind of anticlimactic for me personally. The original one had 4 games in one, and none of them were really that good. But you liked hearing the soundtrack, and you liked to be involved with the franchise. But their second video game they came out with, and there's only two, is one called Tron Deadly Discs. And you stepped into it, and they had really pushed the envelope on this game. Now, most video games were made out of either a kind of a fighter pilot joystick, a round knob, or a little, you know, arcade buttons. And that was usually most of the games. If you had anything different than that, it was a lot different. One of the games I used to play was Sub Rock 3D, where you sat in, you put your head in these polarized lenses, and you could play a sort of a boats coming by, and you were always hitting in with submarines and stuff, and it was all in 3D, and I was really good at that game. Every once in a while I get the high score, but it wouldn't be normally knocked down. But I get inside Tron Deadly Discs, and you stood inside the cabinet, and it had speakers all around you with massive subwoofers, and so you were in this Tron world. And the game was essentially that you jumped up and down on top of discs, and you had a disc battle with the guy on the other side, which was usually Sark. Start off with one disc, then you got two discs, then you got three discs, and the discs started going up and down. And this controller was the disc, and you could pull it up and down. When the game got to that level, you would use it to pull up and down. It was tremendous. I played this game, and the highest score you could actually register on the game was 999,000, I believe. or sorry, no, 99,000, I think, was the top score you could have on the game. And so I play this game. My very first coin I throw in this thing. And I just mentioned this because this was sort of the euphoric thing that could happen every once in a while. A game was made for you. Whatever it was that you were good at, everything came together in one spot. And talk about a reinforcement of your abilities. I played this game forever. And my family, just a couple of my buddies actually, were out playing other games. And they were done with all their quarters. And I was still playing this game. So I left, put my initials up there, took off. I came back for months. And my high score, my very first play, was the high score on this machine. And it was, and again, they really, really fought to make sure the power was never turned off at any of the machines. So that was a super cool experience. But then I left the Midwest in 87, came to California. And then we had a couple advancements that were very interesting. One of the big advancements was a game called Dragon's Lair. And Dragon's Lair was a movie, a cartoon movie made by Disney of a soldier that was all comically trying to kill this dragon and trying to go through these different scenes. The game was built out of a laser disc of the cartoon. And these guys had masterfully figured out how to put a little playhead all over this disc such that when you made a choice, like a choose-your-own-adventure thing, it would simply tab to a different part of the disc and start playing that part of the engine. So the whole time that you're playing the game, you're queuing left, right, front, back choices, and it would simply go to the different place in the movie and start playing that. And you had to swing your sword at a certain time, which means you had to hit the little arcade button. But it was all just queuing off this disc. There's been, I think, one other game like it, which was a sequel to that game, or a sister game to that, but nothing else like that. And a buddy of mine, Bill, was able to actually get completely to the end, and it just ended. Right? You put your quarter in, and it just ended. And we actually videotaped the whole thing one time with the video camera. But that was a very weird evolution that just never happened again. But I moved to the Bay Area after about 4 years in Southern California. And we had an arcade in San Mateo, California called Tilt. And Tilt was super cool because Tilt was a testing ground for all the video games that were yet to be released to the wild. And so not only would you go in and be able to play all the classic games that you ever loved, but there'd be like weird games sitting around that were super technical, and they were trying to see how people enjoyed the game. You'd walk into the Tilt, which had lost a lot of its, you know, the standard arcade game, just arcade room feel where they would close it all up and make it dark. This was kind of like a big giant slice out of the first floor of this mall, right? And so you had a lot of the light coming in from the mall, which had a big skating rink off to the side. And I think the mall is still there. It was the Fashion Island Mall. We have a Fashion Island Mall in Newport Beach, but it's a different one up there. It had great Orange Julius hamburgers. That's the one thing I remember. But I remember walking up to a game that was massive. Like the cabinet that held this thing was utterly huge. Probably almost twice the size of a normal game. And I looked down inside this thing, and it's like a mech warrior game where you're a mechanized machine. I played these on the computer, but this thing was massively detailed, hugely, you know, like the resolution was amazing. And I remember playing it for one day because they took the machine away. It crashed all the time. And so you could play the thing for free because they were just trying to work out all the bugs. And they had people in clipboards trying to get people to play the game. And nobody would play it but me. So I'm sitting there, and it's during my lunch break, so I can't sit there forever. But I'm playing this game over and over. And it crashed so much that you sort of didn't want to play it after a while because even if it was free, you couldn't really accomplish anything, right? Your score kept going to zero. But that was cool. But Konami, I think it was Konami, made a game that was a motorcycle racing game. And you walked up to it, and there was four motorcycle bikes, like crotch rocket type bikes. And obviously, it's not the whole bike. It's just the seat with the handlebar and kind of a platform that you get up on, right? And it's multiplayer. Four people could race on a track at the same exact time. Now, brilliantly, they put a fifth monitor in the center that was sort of a... you see it all the time now in Gran Turismo type games where you always have a camera that can just watch the race from any vantage point. So you had this monitor that was you, and everyone else could sit there and watch the race from this sort of vantage point. But the reason why I mentioned this game is that they were utterly brilliant when it came to the design of this game. To this day, you'll see this algorithm every once in a while. You'll see it in mobile games a lot. I used to play with two of my friends from work, and then we get always like a fourth person from the arcade to jump on. And we slaughtered this game. And yours truly was probably one of the best players of the game. I mean, I won all the time. But one of the things they did that was brilliant was it was all about, you know, racing. It was sort of when to brake, when to accelerate, when to how to cut the apex of the turn, that kind of thing. So with my background in racing and having helped make Andretti Racing at EA, it was really intense. In fact, I hadn't even done the Andretti Racing thing yet because it's probably about 92 to 95, somewhere in there, right? Andretti Racing was 96. But the cool thing was that if you got really ahead of your friends, the game would super boost their bikes a little bit. You couldn't tell. There was no fire coming out of the bike or anything, but they'd slow me down and they'd speed up my friends. And the brilliant thing about that was it didn't really take off the edge of my lead, but it kept us together as a pack. Instead of us being all over the map, all over the course, someone at Konami was brilliant. I said, the people play this game to be together. And so we're going to write algorithms to make sure that they're together. And it wasn't drafting or anything like that, because, you know, we're never that close to each other to get the drafting algorithm going. It was just something they did that was brilliant, right? Now, meanwhile, of course, pinball machines are going up into digital form. And they, I think it was the KISS pinball machine about 1979 that started replacing all the tumbler numbers with digital readouts. Now, my experience, just briefly to shut this thing down, my experience with pinball games was actually fairly interesting because my father was a huge pinball dude. I guess when he was a kid with his buddies in school, they used to do a couple things. One, they used to play the living shit out of pinball games down at the local bowling alley in Chanute, Kansas. And they had one machine that had a flaw in its design, such that if you hit the ball at a certain speed, a certain angle on the flipper, it would hit some texture on the playing field, and the ball would jump up and smack the glass. And about every 10th time, they could break the glass in the pinball machine, which was not tempered glass. So it was essentially breaking into these really dangerous shards, of course. And of course, the owner would always get very upset, but they would just go down every once in a while and break this glass on this thing. But my father actually brought pinball machines home, and we would service them and sell them. And there was a huge market for it because in the early 80s, you know, guys who had grown up in the 60s really loved them, and so we would just roll these things. So I had a lot of experience with that. But at the same time that, you know, arcade games were just taking over, the pinball machine, Bally, Williams, and Gottlieb all got together and kept juicing up these machines. And nowadays, of course, some of you still play these things. They're unbelievable. You know, the playing fields became extremely three-dimensional. What you can do with the ball is quite phenomenal. You can get six or seven balls on the court at one time. Really cool stuff. So that moved up quite a bit as well. It did lose a little bit of its finesse from being analog, you know. And again, you can the arcade that was called Tilt was named after the principle that, you know, when you're playing a pinball machine, you can bump the machine. And once you can bump the machine, you can make the ball go a lot of places that it wasn't designed to go. And they figured this out, and they built this into the game design such that you were allowed to bump the game just a little bit. But they put this little pendulum inside the game, and they put a little metal bracket, a little metal circle around the pendulum. And if you bump this thing too much, too often, or too hard, the pendulum would rock up, and if the circuit completed where the metal bar, which had a little bit of current through it, hit the edge of that thing and broke the circuit on this outer ring, it would say Tilt, and the whole game would go dead until the ball went down the center, your flippers didn't work anymore, no more score, says Tilt, and you forfeit that ball, right? So that's why the thing was called Tilt. Sadly, video games never had a need for that kind of thing. But now, what took over arcade games? Why don't we have these arcades anymore? And the good news is that they're starting to remake them here in L.A. I guess there's a big arcade that's been turned on in Anaheim that I need to go visit. Consequently, when Tron Legacy came out, they actually built a copy of Flynn's Place, which is a big arcade in the movie Tron from 1982. They built one on the grounds of California Adventure Park at Disneyland. And you went in, it was, again, they completely missed out on what an arcade looked like. They lit the place up really bright, so it just completely robbed the room of its incredible luster, right? I'm going to loop back on a couple games like Donkey Kong and Pac-Man and a few other ones before we get out of here, but the home console units, right, which we now have PlayStation, Xbox as the main two, they were starting to come through the homes, and so the 2600 ended up getting hundreds of games for it, but the tech inside the game, inside the unit, never got any more powerful, so competitors started coming out, right? And television was the very next one, which I mentioned a long time ago in the, I think, the 80s episode, but this was a system that had a lot more power in it, and it had controllers that had a number pad on it and a disc that you could turn with your finger, and so what happened was you get the game, and the game came with the cart that goes inside the machine, and it came with these cover slips that you'd put in over the numbers. And so it would customize the controller to look like the game. So if you had a space game, it looked like a space controller. Obviously today we just update the screen on our phones, right? But it was the first time you ever had actuated legs in a character. So most of the time it'd be just like a character, a stick figure kind of going around. Maybe he'd have a sword in his hand, but when television came out, you actually had intelligent vision, right? Sort of the way they did that. And that thing blew up and started eating Atari's shorts a little bit. And then about 5 years later, another game console came out, which I forgot to mention, which is called the ColecoVision. And ColecoVision really had an amazing start, had a bunch of really cool games. You could tell it was a pretty powerful machine for its day. But it never quite had the games to create the utter addiction. And they didn't seem to have any franchise partnership with anyone. So you couldn't play a game from the arcade inside your ColecoVision. So they had to come up with completely original games constantly. And that's a really tough order. Now, I miss the Nintendo and the Super Nintendo completely because, one, I had arcades around me. I also had, in my home, I had the 2600, the television, and the ColecoVision. So there were others that came and went that my dad would buy, and we'd use them for a little while and take them back because they just sucked. But those are the three big ones. But by the time the Super Nintendo came out, the processor power was pretty huge and very, very equal to the arcades. And so people were staying home and playing in their homes and not spending a quarter every single time they wanted to play a game. And, you know, we all know the Mario Brothers, Super Mario Brothers, all these different games that became utterly popular on these machines. And so obviously in the 90s, we had this transition to home console games, and, you know, sort of the rest is history, right? We got the Sega Genesis, Sega Dreamcast, which fell on its face, PlayStation 1, 2, 3, 4. Eventually the Xbox went through three iterations of its own, and now we're sitting here with amazing HD 1080p experiences in these machines. But now, you know, a game is $70 and it might suck and you can't walk away from it once you buy it. Last time I had my PS3, I worked at EA, and so I was able to get a lot of games from them for nothing. And but you know, most of them weren't that fun, right? So I wanted to give you guys a sort of a tour down memory lane when it came to arcades, because it was an era in our history that I think is sadly missing. The big benefits of these arcades was that it was sort of an immersive social experience with your buddies. You would play with your friends, just like you did in the pinball era. It was really funny. I was watching Daredevil from Marvel Netflix. In the second season, there's a scene where a guy has to get something that's been placed underneath the pinball machine, and so he needs to come up there and get it, and there's two guys playing the pinball machine. They kind of dramatize this up that these guys are mad that the guy's standing there, and so he takes a quarter and he puts it on the glass and he slides it down to the front of the machine and he goes, "I'm next." And I realized that there was at least two people in the room that didn't know anything about what that meant. And the way that you actually pushed in on a video game was that you would put your quarters that you want to spend on the game on the edge of the screen. You just put them all up there. Sometimes the cabinets weren't built well, and you put your quarter up there and fall down into the slit, and you couldn't get your quarter out, and that's when you got the black quarter, right? Or someone came up and scooped it out with a stucco knife, right? So a couple of the other big evolutions in games in the 80s, or some of the big titles, obviously, was Pac-Man came out and had so much music. It had little cutscenes between the levels. I was never a big Pac-Man fan. I just thought it was too claustrophobic. Not my favorite kind of game. Donkey Kong, again, it only had like four levels, but they just kept getting more and more intense. My cousin, who's a girl, absolutely murdered Pac-Man, Miss Pac-Man, and Donkey Kong. You couldn't touch her. Unbelievable. The other one was fighting games. Fighting games got really amazing in the late 80s. So you had your first Street Fighters. You had your Mortal Kombats. It really all started, as far as I know, with a Japanese game where you had two guys that were fighting in gis. You know, one was white, one was red. And, you know, you had the crane technique you could get into and that kind of stuff. So sort of a side fighter. And that's where it actually launched, in my opinion and my understanding, right? But this social experience is lost. And as much as we play it online in our own bedrooms, there's something about getting out. There's something about meeting people. There's something about having these really emotional experiences together. One of my closest friends, who was the one that was able to finish Dragon's Lair, he's a tall, lanky, nerdy guy. And he's this amazing game producer to this day. But he was the very best Street Fighter player on planet Earth. I mean, just unbelievable, right? And so we go to these arcades that, you know, when the gangster thing started happening in L.A., you know, it was pretty much the early 80s, but by the late 80s, just before NWA came out, there'd be a lot of bangers in these arcades. And there was a weird bravado of their outer muscle mass and their foreboding appearances and how they could play a game. They wanted to be as badass in these video games as they were perceivably in their own persona in their own life, right? And so my buddy would go up and see these bangers playing this Street Fighter and, or Mortal Kombat or Virtual Fighter, and he'd put his quarter up there, and you know, just wait for it to kind of get the point he could play. And they're really excited because he's so lanky they could knock him out in one punch, right? But they put the quarter in, and he would just blow them completely away, just beat them so fast that they were utterly pissed off, right? But first game, okay, I wasn't ready, man, right? And so he put another quarter in, he'd wipe them out, and they would get really pissed, and they're saying, well, you're cheating because you're playing that guy, and that guy's the strongest guy, whatever stupid excuse they could come up with. And so one of the things he would do, these guys' chicks were there too half the time. He'd give them a quarter, and he put it in, and he'd go, okay, fine. You pick which character I'm going to play, if that's what you think, right? And they'd always pick a girl. And they'd laugh it off. Oh, you have to play a girl now. I know it sounds juvenile, but their perception was that the girls were weaker. And Billy said, he goes, look, man, he goes, the girls are the most powerful ones in the game, and they always pick the girls. And so he kicked their ass even faster. It was utterly hilarious. And it was one point where, like, a golf and stuff, it's middle of the afternoon, and this dude literally, you know, pushed away from the game physically and essentially challenged my buddy to a fight in real life because he got his ass so handed to him. Never happened, thank God. So there was this interesting thing, which is why I think you need to hear it. If there's an arcade in your area, especially if you have a son or something, you might want to go down yourself first so you don't break his little heart, but if your girl's into it too, do it. These are built for kids and adults all at the same time, which is the other amazing thing, is that, you know, a lot of the modern warfare games and stuff, you know, you're navigating first-person shooters with your thumb on this horrible control system. I've been to plenty of game conferences where the little kids cannot navigate with these controls. And the guys who make the video game, who are trying to show it off, are all frustrated that little kids can't figure out how to play the game. And I'm just looking at them going, it's because these controls suck on these home console systems. You need a joystick, man. You need a keyboard if you're going to go really insane, right? But if you can find an arcade in your local town, I'm hoping that you can have at least a smidgen of this experience, because it is worth your life, I think, to get into this a little bit. Now, the games did go from one quarter to a dollar to, I think some of these games are almost $2 because they got to be massive installations, right? You would sit down inside race cars. Some of them had 3D interfaces, that kind of thing. I think you want to start with the old-fashioned ones. And hopefully, if nothing else, the environment that I'm talking about is somehow preserved. You know, the big brag is that the one over in Anaheim is exactly that. Dark cave of 50 games. I think that's kind of cool. So, this is from one old-timer to another, or to you youngins. We had something really cool called arcades back in the day. And I do not think they exist. So I want to put this episode out because it's just kind of a fun thing down memory lane. If you made it this far, thanks for listening. As always, mkultraradio.com for all the feeds. This show's called Deep Thoughts. If you like it, please subscribe. If you dig this particular episode, please give me a thumbs up. Lay your comments in the comments area. Tell me what games you love that I forgot. Or, I sit here and I just think about the games and I know I'm missing some. I used to play, like, Gorf was another one I used to play all the time. But anyway, let me know what was your favorite game. And let's chit-chat about it. All right, brothers and sisters, take care of yourself and someone else. And I will see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over now.